Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Politics and Polemics, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Magu. I also host my own podcasts, Independent Thought and Freedom, and also A Story Club, Global Politics and Global Cultures. Today, my guest is Spencer Critchley, author of the book, Patriots of Two Nations, Why Trump Was Inevitable and What Happens Next, published by McDavid Media, out now. Welcome, Spencer.
Oh, it's good to be with you, Kirk.
All right. Yeah, well, congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
To start off, what we like to do is have the author, yourself in this case, tell us about yourself, and in particular, in relationship to the subject of this book. So what's your background as it led you here?
Sure. Well, my background is in all different forms of media and communication. I actually started out as a songwriter and producer in the music business way back. But over the years, I've worked in journalism, interactive media in Silicon Valley, basically all forms of communication, and I think all forms of media. And at a certain point, I started doing political communication consulting after getting interested in politics during the 2004 election, actually. And eventually, that led me to working on both Obama campaigns, and I helped out a little with the Hillary Clinton campaign as well. And it was actually election night 2016, and I was as shocked as anybody else when Hillary lost to Donald Trump, that got me thinking along the lines that finally led to this book. I was trying to make sense of how we could have come to this point. And my research ended up taking me back to the founding of this country and, in my case, the writing of this book.
Right, right. It's interesting. You started off as a songwriter and producer. I'm very fascinated by that, by the whole music industry, as I suppose many people are. How did you get into politics from that? Was it, I suppose there are tons of links between the music industry and politics, but I'd be interested to hear your story.
Sure. Well, it didn't seem to make much sense at the time. In retrospect, it does. I can see my whole life is based on communication in one form or another, where it's through music or journalism or writing or even computer code in some cases. I got into politics really almost by accident. A friend of mine invited me to help out the local Democratic Party here in Monterey County, California. And because he knew of my background in communication and all these different forms. And I was kind of holding my nose because, like a lot of people, I kind of assumed it was, you know, politics was a seamy business full of power hungry weasels, basically. Mm-hmm. And I was doing it really out of a sense of civic obligation. And to my surprise, I discovered some just terrific people who actually were pursuing public service for all the right reasons, including our local member of Congress at the time, Sam Farr, who became quite a mentor for me. And it struck me that here was an opportunity to apply my communication skills and the creativity that I had always been drawn to in connection with that, in a way that would actually make a difference for the world. So My volunteer work led to me being hired to work on Sam Farr's campaigns and some local elected officials' campaigns. And when I the first time I saw one of my candidates get elected and know that a really good person had gotten elected, or that a school bond measure had been passed in one case that raised $90 million to repair some terribly rundown schools in a working class neighborhood in Salinas, California. This was really inspiring. And then when I got asked to join the Obama campaign in 2008, that was one of the most inspiring experiences of my life. And so actually, for the first time in my life working on the Obama campaign, I found something that I found as deeply satisfying as way back I had always found music. Because in its own way, it was creative. And the idea of serving something so big and so important was every bit as inspiring as music had ever been.
Wow. Yeah, that's a great story. Now, in no way to undermine it, it reminds of a counterpoint that Pete Townsend made once, I remember. He said he was dismissing all the kind of political activism in the 1980s and saying, tell me what's more important. What's changed the world more than a guitar?
Well, yeah, I'm very sympathetic to both sides of that argument. Pete Townsend's one of my heroes. And I actually worked, you know, in my own musical career. Of course, I have a lot of experience with, I was a guitar player, was my first instrument. And one of my jobs was working with Thomas Dolby at a company called Beatnik, running the creative department at Beatnik, which was a fascinating internet company.
Yeah, he was really cutting edge in the 1980s, wasn't he?
Oh, absolutely. He's a brilliant person, and he's also one of my musical heroes. As it happens, it was such a thrill to get to work so closely with him, and also just a brilliant thinker. But I grew up with that feeling, that belief that a guitar could change the world, that music could change the world, which really dates to the 60s, and in many ways, unfortunately, it proved really not to be true. You know, George Harrison, to cite another great 60s musical figure, once said, I think, that the summer of love lasted for about 5 minutes. And it very quickly got absorbed into the giant marketing machinery of the entertainment industry. And if you look at the difference between 60s idealism in the music business versus where we are now with things like Super Bowl halftime shows and American Idol, I actually mentioned this in my book, it's a very different situation. And I often feel actually that rock music and other forms of popular music have really just become vehicles of consumer culture. I have very mixed feelings about the music industry on that score.
Yeah, that would be a fascinating discussion in and of itself. But let's get to your book, because those issues are really interesting. And in fact, as you say, you do touch on them in your book. So let's start off with the basic fundamentals. What do you mean by two nations, and why is it important?
Right. Well, as I researched the history in connection with, to me, this incredible development of Donald Trump becoming elected president, I realized that the division that we're seeing now does go back to the beginning of the country. And I concluded that really the United States has never been united. And it's always actually been two nations occupying one territory. And the ultimate source of that division, I believe, dates to the Enlightenment of the 18th century. And the Enlightenment, of course, was the triumph of reason, as exemplified by Enlightenment thinkers like Voltaire and Montesquieu and John Locke. And the founders of the country, of the United States, explicitly based the design for the United States on Enlightenment principles of reason, including John Locke's social contract, which heavily influenced Jefferson in the writing of the Declaration of Independence and heavily influenced the Constitution. They assumed, you know, it feels presumptuous to criticize the thinking of towering figures like the founders of the United States, but I think they made a fundamental mistake. They assumed that the triumph of reason was final, and that they could create a new form of nation, the civic nation, meaning as a nation founded on a social contract instead of on ethnicity, basically, a tribal identity. and they assumed this was the path of history going forward. What they did not appreciate, I believe, was the strength of the counter-Enlightenment. And the counter-Enlightenment was the resistance movement to the Enlightenment. And it's almost been lost to history, at least as far as the average person is concerned. Scholars are certainly aware of it. But our education and our cultural tradition assumes that the Enlightenment is the worldview, essentially, that science tells us what's true, you know, and we use facts and logic and reason to debate to solve disagreements, etc. The counter-Enlightenment, and there were serious counter-Enlightenment thinkers, argued that reason is a very small form of truth. Yes, it can tell you what's mathematically true or what's scientifically true, but it doesn't capture the incredible richness and complexity of real life. And for that, you need faith, tradition, art and culture, and yes, ethnic identity. Counter-Enlightenment thinkers believed there was something essential to being a German or being French or English or Italian or whatever that could not be sort of dissolved into this universal set of principles describing human nature the way that you can have universal principles of physics or chemistry. So I believe it's the implications of these two worldviews are that you actually define truth differently and you define what the source of authority should be differently. And if you fast forward to the present day and you look at these arguments between pro-Trump and anti-Trump people, where they'll often report, my God, it's like the other person's living in a different reality. My conclusion is they are living in a different reality. So I'm somebody from the Enlightenment legacy, I'm a political liberal. So people like me will offer facts and logic to Trump supporters, for example, about the coronavirus pandemic or about things the president has said that are obviously untrue and which are shown to be untrue by, you know, videotaped evidence or written evidence, and find that it bounces off his supporters. Well, a lot of the explanation for that is whether they know it or not, I believe his supporters are operating within this counter-Enlightenment worldview where loyalty to a leader in a sort of pre-Enlightenment mode, it's more really from the Middle Ages and before, and faith, whether it's religious faith or just faith in intuition and tradition and ethnic identity and culture will easily trump, so to speak, facts and logic. And that is a lot of, I think ultimately that's what's going on here. And it has many different aspects, but I think that's the sort of umbrella concept that captures how American history led us to this moment.
Yeah, I sympathize a lot with your argument and your journey as well, because I too, you know, was educated and grew up in a big city. I was Toronto. And
I lived in Toronto for 7 years, I think, or more. I was in Toronto for quite a while.
I see your CBC background.
Yeah.
I was there in the 70s and 80s. And you know, I mentioned Pete Townsend. I remember when they did their final farewell concert at Maple Leaf Gardens. But I mean, I'm a musician.
I might have been at the same concert.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure we must have crossed paths at several points. I grew up so much in a liberal consciousness, and the whole idea growing up was that conservatives are stupid,
right.
And that if you if you were at all concerned about humanity or books or anything. Cultural or artistic or of the higher faculties, then obviously you were a liberal because conservatives, they liked sports and, read the stupid newspapers, the tabloids, and there was this, real entrenched prejudice and this, looking down. And I was totally into that. And one of the things that postmodernism was interesting for me because it actually draws a lot on the counter-Enlightenment, which a lot of people don't understand. And that's kind of been swept under the carpet, but definitely Foucault and Derrida and these thinkers were drawing on counter-Enlightenment ideas. So that was introducing some stuff to me, like Nietzsche and other things. And then Camille Paglia in the 1980s, I just fell in love with her. I just love Camille Paglia. And she introduced me to the whole sort of decadence and romantic movement and this counter-enlightenment in the arts, and which we always knew. And in the music industry, for example, it's pervasive, but we don't really like even things like the pre-Christian traditions and the sort of occult symbols and all these things. Zeppelin and all their symbols and Jimmy Page with Aleister Crowley and all this stuff.
And Tolkien.
Tolkien. And it goes back to this, but it's kind of hidden. It's occulted. And then when I did my PhD, I read for my PhD at the University of Hull, and we had one of the country's leading conservative thinkers in the department. I was amazed. I just couldn't believe this whole world of thought, very, very interesting, and many of which you talk about in the book, was just sort of hidden from me. I never knew about all the varieties of counter enlightenment thought, particularly coming out of Europe. Mm-hmm. It was not stupid in the least. I mean, it was it was extremely influential. And I felt really angry. I felt really angry that I was deprived of this exciting knowledge, in fact. I don't know if you felt the same sort of
That's so interesting. That really parallels my development a lot. And, I remain a liberal, but I think a much more aware liberal. And mm-hmm. I, like you, grew up with that set of assumptions that once somebody became educated and freed their mind from prejudice and ignorance, of course they'd be a liberal. And it used to puzzle me that apparently intelligent, educated people were not liberals. And I wondered, how could that possibly happen?
Yeah.
And I still run into this very frequently. And my fellow liberals are unaware, I think, the extent to which they actually themselves are living inside an intellectual and cultural bubble, and how they come across as incredibly arrogant. and we frequently hear this. Yeah, and condescending. We frequently hear this from the right, and we arrogantly dismiss it. We essentially say, oh, you don't know what you're talking about. That's ridiculous.
Yes.
And, when you hear stupid, hateful stuff coming from people on the right, it makes it easy to dismiss it, or bigoted and racist and all the worst of it. But the thing is, there are, as you say, very thoughtful people who are conservatives. I actually don't think Trumpism has much to do with classical conservatism. It's a, ethno-nationalist populism, really. But when we hear there are intelligent conservatives who do draw on a counter-enlightenment tradition, it's certainly going back to Edmund Burke, who was horrified by the French Revolution as an example of, Enlightenment reason gone mad. And to that extent, at least, I agree with him. I mean, the Jacobins were horrible. And you're also right, I feel, that all of us are drawn to the counter-enlightenment, even if we think of ourselves as enlightenment thinkers. And once we start to look at the way we really think and what our actual assumptions and beliefs are, we realize that they're mutually contradictory in many ways. So those of us who believe in reason as the path to tolerance and inclusion and equality and democracy itself, ultimately, and I do believe in all those things, also have to take account of the fact that we love romantic poetry, and the romantics were very much counter-enlightenment figures. William Blake hated the Enlightenment.
Absolutely.
And thought it had produced the dark satanic mills of the Industrial Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout, as you say, the 60s counterculture with the reinvigoration of magic and tribalism,
Eastern spirituality,
drug taking in the search for transcendent experiences, and almost the fetishization of traditional tribalistic cultures, the romantic views of Native Americans or other Native cultures around the world, even, rock and roll. We were talking about rock music earlier. Well, that was essentially white people looking for some kind of counter-enlightenment connection to something more soulful. Right. And then we have a form of music, and I mentioned this in the book as well, there's a form of music called soul, which, as I say, was kind of named for what white people felt was missing from their culture.
That's right. That's right. And I mean, you know, another thing too is that's part of that. Now, I'll tell you, in 2008, we might have found ourselves in different places. When Obama first came out, I was totally amazed at first and impressed and whatnot, especially when Hillary was still the front runner and Obama was just this figure out of nowhere. I was fascinated by that whole movement. But, you know, I'll tell you, one thing that really was solidified for me was the liberal reaction to Sarah Palin. It was such a visceral hatred for her, and I was amazed. Here was a woman who was the most popular governor in the country, who fought corruption on her, you know, in her own party, and was a young woman, in a position of power, and the feminists hated her. They couldn't stand her, and it wasn't rational. It was not right, and the reaction was not rational. It was visceral, and it was tribal, mm-hmm. and then it really emphasized to me the tribal markers of liberalism, that they like to say they're rational and scientifically oriented and evidence based and et cetera, et cetera. But if you don't have the right accent, if you didn't go mm-hmm. to the right schools, and you know, she had five children. Oh my God. You know, and and she believed in God. She didn't read the right newspapers. She didn't read at all. You know, all these things. These are actually tribal markers that the liberal tribe, if you want to put it that way, are totally oblivious about. And so they lack that self-awareness, which I think you are, you are really kind of pointing to in some ways, although you're concentrating on the counter enlightenment here, but you're bringing it within at least that frame. I'd like to hear your comment on that.
No, absolutely. And a lot of the goal, I would say the goal I have for the book primarily is to help enlightenment thinkers expand their minds to mm-hmm. picture what it's like to think completely differently and be led to greater compassion for people who think so differently from them and who live so differently. A lot of it is that we are raised in this enlightenment framework, and it's as if we're asking fish to imagine what it's like to walk on land. And it's so far outside your experience. Or as I say in the book, I quote Wittgenstein saying, if a lion could talk, we would not be able to understand him, meaning that the lion might be able to learn to speak our language, but his experience of life would be so different, it would make no sense to us. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, what I'm trying to tell Enlightenment liberals, as well as moderate conservatives, we might call all of these people sort of small L classical liberals, that in many ways, we created the conditions for Trump, or we helped to create them. There are many, many factors, and we can't take responsibility for all of it, but we certainly contributed. And a lot of it was through this inability to see how people could think so differently, and our really elitist dismissal of people who thought so differently. Mm-hmm. And some of that, and what that does is, first of all, it makes the average person who's, the average Trump supporter is just an average American, really. A lot of them are really very nice people. I think they're very seriously mistaken. But it leaves them open, since we're not addressing their concerns, to a bunch of con artists to come in and seize that space and talk to them in a language that they respond to, which is what people like Trump and Sarah Palin do. I think ultimately Sarah Palin is a con artist as well. But I think you're also right that liberals' dislike of somebody like Sarah Palin is a form of class-based contempt that they're not even aware of. Yeah. And I think one of the things that happened in recent history in the United States is, thanks to the incredible boom in prosperity following World War II, which is really, I have a graph in my book which shows that suddenly prosperity went vertical after being almost flat for most of human history, prosperity growth in the Western world, especially in the United States. So this enabled, along with various government programs, a whole generation of Americans to go to college. And I think one of the results of that was that Democrats, traditionally the party of working Americans, kind of lunch bucket Americans, lost connection with their working class roots double quick.
Yeah.
And became embarrassed by them.
That's
and
right.
I've often been struck throughout my life. Actually, when I first went to college, I was struck by how snooty and arrogant suddenly everybody was.
Mm-hmm.
And these were, and this was in Canada, you know, which is
very,
you know, center left country. I went to Dalhousie University, was the first place I went, and in Nova Scotia. And I was struck by suddenly how all these, you know, it's not like Nova Scotia is a hotbed of, you know, the upper of elitist, you know, upper class lifestyle. If you saw a fancy car when I was growing up, you'd talk about it for a week.
But all their parents are fishermen, but they were pretending they were.
Yeah, but suddenly it's suddenly like we're in the salons of Paris or something. And and, you know, a year before we were in high school. And that has always struck me. And this, you're right, this dismissiveness of working class Americans, unless they're of the right sort.
Yes.
You know, and often that, you know, and by that, I mean, they sort of match our ideological assumptions about what the working class should be like.
That's right.
Many years ago, Tom Wolfe, you know, wrote the, I always have to struggle to remember the exact title, but it's the Electric Kool-Aid Tangerine Dream Flake Baby.
That's right.
About the custom car culture in the United States. I think he wrote this in the early 60s, maybe.
Yeah.
And he mentions in that book, you know, the idea of customizing cars, you know, and painting them these amazing colors and adding all this chrome and spending all this money doing it, which is a working class, you know, hobby, looks to a kind of typical liberal, you know, Enlightenment viewpoint, like a terrible waste of money by working people who can't afford it, and also just in very bad taste.
Yes.
And Wolf saw it empathetically as an art form and as something that these folks really got a lot of satisfaction from doing. And he talks about how, you know, to liberals, the assumption is once you, you know, free people from the shackles of capitalism and consumerism and all of this, they will, of course, you know, enroll in the new school for social research and start wearing tweed jackets with leather elbow patches and smoking a pipe and reading poetry. But he says, no, they're probably going to want to buy a big motorboat or something.
And, that's right.
And we should not just dismiss people for doing what they actually spontaneously want to do.
And this is kind of like, the dilemma I think many liberals faced with rap music, that you know, the poor oppressed African American ghetto people, now, you know, well, there's when they become famous and rich or whatever, they're not becoming public enemy and fighting the system, but they're boasting about their yachts and mansions and women, and it's like, oh wait, what are we supposed to, aren't we supposed to be you know, isn't this supposed to be a progressive battle? And I don't think they've wrapped their heads around it. That,
no,
you
exactly.
Know, it, the working class is not going to, you know, have a Marxist proletarian revolution.
Exactly. I talk about this in the book as well. This drives me crazy because to me, it recapitulates colonialism culturally, where, you know, educated, privileged white people look at hip hop culture. This certainly isn't true of all of them, but it's very common, I think, to look at it in a touristic kind of dilettantish way.
Yeah.
And expect that, as you say, hip hop artists, of course, they must be political revolutionaries, but, you know, distressingly, many poor people would really prefer to be in the middle class or upper or rich. And
Trumpish, right?
I mean, well, or just, you know, if you're poor, if you're actually poor, if you're not a theoretical poor person, but if you're an actual real poor person, you don't want to be poor.
That's
and you probably don't have time to be thinking about, you know, Marxist-Leninist theory or, you know.
Absolutely.
post-structuralist critiques of culture and all of this sort of stuff, right? You would really prefer to have a good job and make a decent living and get somewhere in life. And, you know, this is also reflected in the privileged liberals' use of the term bourgeois or bougie. And if you're actually poor, being bourgeois is a dream come true.
That's right.
Also, we see it in, and this really drives me crazy, is when you see typically white, black-clad anarchists showing up in mostly African-American neighborhoods where the black people are demonstrating because they want better police, you know, fairer, more humane policing. And these outside anarchists come in. I think that the right is exaggerating the threat from them, but they do exist. They come in and they want to overturn the capitalist system, and they want to recruit these black people in, you know, their cause of world revolution. And to me, that's right. Just they don't have to live in this neighborhood. They get to go home.
Exactly.
And they are co-opting and appropriating, and I would say colonizing, the culture, or sorry, the cause of these black people who have far more serious and pressing issues to deal with. And in some cases, these are matters of life and death.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Absolutely. And I want to just get into, you know, one more little aspect about the noting but that the liberals tribe, if you want to put it that way, are tribal as well, and they haven't escaped it as they think. A lot of these ideas in the counter enlightenment that you talk about, I mean, definitely made their way into psychology and so forth. Carl Jung and mythology and archetypes and all this into psychology and into advertising. So the liberal, and one of the easiest people to market to are to like the liberals, right? It's easy to manipulate the, you know, like Apple in a sense is one of the big, you know, it's like a cult, right? It's so easy to market to them, you know, by tapping into their irrational side, and they don't even know it. And this understanding of the irrational side that exists in all of us and will never go away. I think that's something you point to in the book a lot I guess pointing toward a solution by the end. I know we're skipping over a lot, but I think that's kind of how you have it. Am I right there?
Yes. And, you know, and to me, the secret in all of this, the answer lies in awareness, not judgment. So, yeah. That includes becoming aware of ourselves.
Right.
And this is tremendously liberating, I found in my own life. You know, we are just, I think, wired to pass judgment on everything, to decide, certainly culturally wired. I'm not sure if it's biological, but certainly in the Western tradition, certainly going back to the Judeo-Christian tradition, if not before. This is another sort of bubble that we live in. We assume that it's as natural as breathing, that we need to decide whether things are good or bad and whether people are good or bad.
Yeah.
And so on the left, you know, we decide that the people on the right are bad or stupid, basically. And in the extreme version, like Jacobinism or the Soviet Union, they have to be either re-educated or ultimately killed because they're getting in the way of the progress of history. But if you stop doing that, if you can just break that habit and become aware, then you become much more compassionate towards other people. You don't have to agree with them.
Yeah.
But you become much more compassionate and your own life becomes better. And then turn the same awareness on yourself and become aware and compassionate about yourself. But in a very clear-eyed way, discover your own prejudices, which frees you from them. And I agree, you know, we on the left like to think, especially, you know, educated liberals, we assume we're above all of this. We're, you know, we're way too sophisticated to be fooled by marketing, for example. But I discovered early on, it's almost scary. In the book I talk about, it's like magic. And in many ways, it has a lot in common with the casting of magical spells. If you show somebody an Apple product or Apple advertising, it's as if you're casting a magical spell. And this works with all kinds of signifiers in our culture. And the ease with which you can get very highly educated critical thinkers to fall into line and do what you want them to do simply by dangling the right symbols in front of them is every bit as powerful as, you know, showing somebody on the right in your stereotypical view, if you show them a fancy new gun, and in your sort of cliched view of these right-wing fools, you know, they instantly need to have this gun because it'll make them feel powerful or whatever you think, you know, your cliche is. But on our side, I mean, just spend some time on Twitter and my God, the conformity, the moment some influential person on Twitter, you know, somebody who writes for the New Yorker or the Atlantic or the New York Times or something, all of which I read and admire. But the moment that somebody influential expresses, this is not cool, and this, on the other hand, is cool. Oh my God, everybody lines up in lockstep almost, it seems. And to find people who are actually willing to risk an original thought remains, as it has throughout much of human history, a special experience when you come across a thinker who's willing to step up.
Because, you know, I'll just share a little story again, like from the Bush era. Right. I mean, I thought Bush was, you know, just incredibly, you know, stupid. And I was totally against the Iraq war, still am, and whatnot. And then, you know, but I discovered the whole Straussian, undercurrent, and I couldn't believe that there were these really incredible, thoughtful people. I may not agree with them, but they really had an intriguing argument and a look at history, and that whole sort of Straussian neocon, Alan Bloom kind of thing. It was very, very, very fascinating, and I started to respect a lot of these conservative people, wondering, you know, they're putting on a stupid front, but you know, really,
yes.
You know, there's this whole, you know, network going on at Harvard and Yale and these people there. And I just found it, wow, you know, this kind of a hidden thing. And even with Trump, like a lot of the alt-right and the dissident right, there are some interesting thinkers there as well that you can see. Now, you know, you may not agree with it or whatever, but once you can concede and admit the humanity, intelligence of the other side, that the you know, both of you, you know, may want similar things, maybe not exactly the same thing, and you know, but you have an assumption of good faith that not the other side is evil and they want to kill, so they're against healthcare because they want to kill old people. Right. Really, does anybody really want to kill old people? I mean, it's. There's a lack of empathy there, trying to understand why would they have such a polar opposite policy opinion to mine? Let's take out the possibility that they're evil and the devil incarnate. You know, so that means we have to now put ourselves in their shoes. And I think that's what you're really doing in the book, aren't you?
Yes, exactly. And through not engaging seriously with conservative thinking, we leave a void to be filled by the people who actually are operating in bad faith.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Trump has, I don't believe, any political philosophy or even moral philosophy. He's just out for himself. He's a lifelong con man. However, that void was left there for him to step into because we abandoned the field, essentially. And
yeah.
And there are so many liberals who actually don't really understand what they're arguing against. And
yes.
I ended up having to learn about this through my work in politics and ironically through advising clients on how to defeat arguments from the other side. And right. In order to do that, you have to understand the other side's argument. Mm-hmm. And this led to a principle for me that I recommend to everybody who's interested, which is become familiar enough with your opponent's thinking so that you could argue persuasively for it.
Yeah.
Because if you can't do that, you don't fully understand it. I mean, these people who have been conservatives all these centuries, they're not just all insane and stupid.
That's right.
Some of them have been, many of them have been very, very intelligent people. So for example, you know, read the work of Hayek on economics. Don't just dismiss it. You know, and you'll find that he's a beautiful writer and writes very clearly. And some of the stuff he says, even as a liberal, you're going to have a hard time disagreeing with.
And that's right.
If you do this and you come out the other side and you're still a liberal, well, in my opinion, you're going to be a better liberal. It's kind of like if you get rich and you're still a liberal, then, or, you know, if you run a business and you're still a liberal, then, you know, you really mean it. And if you fully understand the other side, then I think it makes your own liberalism deeper and frankly, more respectable intellectually. Liberals, and I get into this in the book as well, it's also just leads them to use language in ways they use words as if those words are assumed to mean the same thing or to carry the same freight of values, and don't realize how much they're alienating people on the other side and essentially confirming their biases against us. So, for example, I frequently hear my friends talking about collective action. You know, we will do this collectively or as the community. This is the community coming together, or the famous phrase, it takes a village to raise a child.
Yeah.
Or global village, these kinds of concepts. Now, what they don't realize is to a conservative thinker, all of those things sound kind of scary.
Yes.
And because conservatism believes that freedom must, by definition, start with the individual, or else the individual is being subsumed into the collective. And, you know, many European and Eastern European, especially thinkers, this is where a lot of their conservatism came from, because they had seen what happens when collectivism goes insane, as it did in the Soviet Union. And then, you know, through the domination of Central and Eastern Europe. And so if you say collective as a self-evident good, that does not sound that way to a conservative thinker. So if you want to establish a connection, you need to be more empathic, as you say, Kirk, and imagine how your words are sounding to the other person. And again, you don't have to agree with them, but you do need to be compassionate and try to understand what their world looks like. Same with private property. Marx believed that, you know, people were evil essentially because of private property. And once we got rid of private property, they'd all be nice to each other, basically, which to me now just seems incredibly naive. And in the book, I speculate about, you know, if Marx had lived a little later and had encountered Freud and the death drive and civilization and its discontents, I think it might, I hopefully would have influenced Marx to realize that essentially his view of human nature was naive, in my view. To a conservative thinker, private property is not, as liberals often see it, a tool for capitalists to oppress working people. It's a defense of freedom if an individual has a right to own their own property, because throughout history, that was not true for most people. And it was only when they were able to own and defend their own piece of property as if it were their own little castle that freedom became possible. And so it's understanding these kinds of concepts so that you can actually engage with them in some kind of useful way that I think is critical.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like being an anthropologist, you know, it's putting yourself
That's kind of true, that our cultures are so distinct that it is almost as if, or we're visiting from a different planet or something. And that's the path towards healing this divide. Ultimately, I think, is what's not working for liberals is to continually keep having these enlightenment style debates based on facts and logic. And I'm not at all saying that we should abandon the Enlightenment tradition of reason, because it is precious and it has led to so much of all the forms of progress that we've enjoyed, whether political or technological or whatever. However, it's not working.
That's right. But I would also add that on the counter-Enlightenment side, even among the most radical that purport to be, you know, the most anti-rational or you know, critical of rationality, they still use rational arguments, right? So they still have to, depend, except for perhaps the most extreme ones that don't even write or anything like that. But the ones that reduce themselves to writing, must deal with logos. And so they too are not beyond the Enlightenment and the whole free speech and the expression of ideas, dissident ideas, right? They depend on that for them to express their dissident views. So there is, even on the other side, they have to concede their debt to Enlightenment liberalism as well. So then you start to move to common ground.
Absolutely. And a lot of that will become possible once people stop hating and fearing each other the way they do now on both sides. This is why I call them patriots of two nations. Each side sees itself as patriotic to their vision of America and sees the other side as a threat to America. And that, of course, means that we have formed hostile tribes and we cannot communicate because we don't trust each other. And so in the book, I argue that on our side, we need to, for the moment, set aside trying to win the argument and reestablish trust, which is going to be based on human connection and shared values. Because I think you mentioned earlier, when it comes down to it, almost I would say all of us, except for psychopaths, share the most important values, which would be that kindness is better than cruelty, and everybody in the democratic world, at least, believes in equality before the law and freedom and, the nonviolent resolution of disputes and a government run as honestly as we can manage. So there, you won't find people who disagree with those values, even something as divisive as abortion. And I use this as a test case in the book. The two sides are talking about completely different things. One side sees abortion as the murder of a child and the destruction of a soul. And the other side sees it as a question of equality for women and, counter-enlightenment views. But neither of the two people who might be arguing from those two sides actually wants to kill children. And
that's
in fact, both of them would agree the life of a child is absolutely precious. And so if you can start there and build the trust first, it turns out once people trust each other, they're much more likely to be influenced by each other. Even people they might disagree with very strongly, they'll attach much more weight to their words just because they know them and trust them. And that's essentially, we're like strangers to each other. It's almost as if we're from different planets, and we have to establish that sense of trust where we can lay down the weapons, see each other as human beings who care about the same things, essentially.
Absolutely. One statistic I always found interesting was that in looking at giving to charities, people who identify as conservatives give much more to charities and people who identify as liberal, which I think people, all these things are important. And it shows that there are, similar ends that both sides agree with, but it's the means might be different. And that's where you can have your discussion, as you say,
Right. It's interesting, if I could, as an anecdote, here in the central coast of California, one of my company, I have a communications consulting company called Boots Road Group here in Monterey, And one of our clients, who I've also volunteered for because I just love what they're doing so much, is called Rancho Cielo Youth Campus. And it's a program to help kids get out of gangs or avoid getting drawn into gangs, because Salinas, California, in the Salinas Valley nearby here, has an extremely serious gang problem. And Rancho Cielo is wonderfully effective. And it's in this beautiful ranch in the hills outside Salinas. And essentially what they're doing there is very liberal in terms of social policy. And yet it was founded by a lifelong Republican judge. When he retired, he'd sent a lot of young men to prison and knew it just was not helping and was actually making things worse. And he got together with a lot of his rich Republican friends. And these people are very conservative. And they weren't thinking ideologically. They just wanted to help. And they created this wonderful program that I think could be a national model. And it's been very, very successful. And as I say, it's, you know, if you look at what they're doing, it's pretty darn liberal, but they don't look at it that way. They look at it as something that works, that will help their community, which they deeply care about.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's both the, the counter-enlightenment and the enlightenment, you know, And it's this, it's two ways of, I guess, showing a care for humanity, right? Because the counter enlightenment see the non-rational sides of humanity, you know, the community and faith and tradition and beauty as being essential to realizing our humanity, while the enlightenment side seeing reason and freedom and rationality and debate and as being essential as well, but they're not mutually exclusive, you know.
No,
as and the course, world and of advertising shows.
Exactly, and I think write a whole separate book about the influence of advertising and marketing in general on culture and democracy, because it's terrifying. But I don't mean to suggest, of course, that people who are primarily in the counter-enlightenment worldview are incapable of reason. You know, in both cases, we sort of have a home base in either one of them, but all of us partake in both modes of thinking. But it's important, I believe, for us to be aware of that and understand that we should integrate both forms of thinking. Sometimes it works better to be intuitive and emotional or to value tradition or to just have faith. Whether or not you're religious, and other times it's better to just be driven by the data.
That's right.
And you know, another area where I think we liberals tend to be blind is that this over-reliance on rationality can take the soul out of things in a very destructive way. And I address this in the book as well. And I mentioned earlier in our conversation that the worst examples of this are things like Jacobinism or the Soviet Union. I refer to that as the Enlightenment gone mad, and Nazism is the counter-enlightenment gone mad. But it also happens in less obviously destructive ways, but they are still destructive. For example, the rise of bureaucracy is a very Enlightenment phenomenon where you rationalize government processes, which in many ways is a good idea because it reduces corruption and makes things generally more effective. However, you can get these soulless bureaucracies that are self-preserving, and you know, in Kafka writes about this very effectively, and it turns out he was quite prophetic. And in my work, for example, I've done a lot of work in gang violence, which is one of the things that led me to Rancho Cielo. I've been deeply disturbed by the role of bureaucracy in perpetuating the gang violence problem,
right,
and many other social problems because of the extreme difficulty of breaking down bureaucratic silos.
Right.
And nobody wants to not be effective. But on the other hand, all the incentives militate against cooperation and collaboration and data sharing. And, you know, what if it involves the elimination of departments or the merger of departments, it's almost impossible to make progress. Now, again, nobody is consciously, I hope, choosing their own job or, you know, their own bureaucratic power structure and budget over actually solving a problem as serious as gang violence. But the fact remains, it's one of the top obstacles to making progress on a problem, by the way, that we actually know how to address very, very effectively. It's not mysterious what to do. It's been done successfully multiple times. And one of the most serious obstacles is bureaucracy, which ultimately is a product of Enlightenment rationalism.
Yeah, and it shows the embeddedness of irrationality even within rational structures.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, we're approaching the end, and I know you have to go. It's been a fascinating discussion, and we went off in all little nooks and crannies. But there's another important concept in your book, which we didn't talk about, and I'd like you to elaborate on it, is why do you say that Trump was inevitable? What do you mean by that? What's your argument about that?
Oh, yes. So, yes, the book is called Patriots of Two Nations, Why Trump Was Inevitable and What Happens Next. And I realized he was inevitable. A lot of people think, well, maybe this division started relatively recently, like with Newt Gingrich in the 90s or, you know, the turmoil of the 60s. But given this split between the Enlightenment and counter-Enlightenment worldviews, somebody like Trump, I think, was going to come along, and he would come along in this form at this particular time because of the role of media and entertainment and consumerism and distraction in our lives would enable a television star specifically a reality show star who's, in my view, a con man, to become president, because he's almost a perfect expression of where we are historically and culturally. There have been many other resurgences of the counter-Enlightenment in American history, and the most violent one was the Civil War, which was fought primarily over slavery, of course, but it was also a revolt of the counter-Enlightenment South against the Enlightenment North. And, you know, the history of evangelism, all sorts of things. Some of other things we've touched on are examples of this conflict between the counter-Enlightenment and the Enlightenment. But somebody like Trump was going to come along, and he's almost the perfect expression, as I say, of this particular moment. And oddly enough, perhaps unsurprisingly, Hillary Clinton was Enlightenment to a fault. You know, she's very, very qualified, very smart, but it was as if she was campaigning on bullet points and was essentially what...
Robotic. I mean, that was a criticism.
Yeah, and she acknowledges it herself. And so the shock that I felt and many people felt, how could such a qualified person lose to such an obviously unqualified one? Well, there you go. The Enlightenment lost to the counter-Enlightenment this time. And, you know, Max Weber, the great German sociologist, described different forms of political authority. And one of them was legalistic, which is sort of the classic civil servant. And I would say that's Hillary Clinton, symbolically at least. And whereas another one is charismatic, and that's Trump, whether you like him or not, he's almost all charisma. And, you know, essentially no substance. For all those reasons, I think somebody like him was inevitable.
And, as you explain that, what came to my mind from the pop culture is the movie Idiocracy.
Oh, yes.
Right, where the President Camacho, the former porn star reality show, whatever, we became president. We're not that far from that in reality.
It's terrifyingly accurate. If anybody has not seen Idiocracy, they need to see it.
Yeah, he predicted it because he read the history.
Yes.
You know, he, which is kind of what you're saying. And it's like you guys saw, you know, we're seeing the same thing in different ways, you know. So in a sense, he predicted, you know, a Trump-like figure because he probably thought it was inevitable as well, just like what you're saying.
Yeah.
So as we close off the interview, I'd just like to ask you, what would you like to leave your readers with after going through your book?
Well, I hope they'll be left with an appreciation for the necessity of and power of awareness, as I was saying a little while ago. Mm-hmm. That we need to set aside judgments for a while. This moralistic judging from both sides, of the other side as ignorant, evil, corrupt, unpatriotic, etc. We just have to stop. And somebody, if the other side doesn't want to stop first, we can stop first. But we need to pursue awareness. Start from awareness and compassion. It doesn't mean forgiving bad behavior, but you can find people of good faith on the other side and stop judging them and try harder to just imagine the world from their point of view and reestablish human connection based on shared values.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank you so much for this interview. It's been really informative and enjoyable.
Oh, I loved it, Kirk. It was just been a sheer pleasure talking to somebody who's obviously so smart and well-educated, and to be able to explore all of these different aspects of it. And you've said things that have sparked new ideas for me. So I really appreciate it.
I'm glad to hear that. Once again, the book is Patriots of Two Nations, Why Trump Was Inevitable and What Happens Next. And we've been speaking to the author, Spencer Critchley. It's been a really insightful conversation and journey, and I recommend that you pick up the book. I think it's very important for people to understand what he's arguing here and prescribing. So I want to thank you, our listeners, as well, and I look forward to seeing you on the next episode.